So welcome, everybody, to the McFarlane's HR podcast for April. I'm Matthew Ramsey. I'm the senior knowledge lawyer in the employment team. And I'm joined this month by Tabitha Almadawi. We're going to talk about harassment. We're going to talk about this fascinating topic, particularly looking at sexual harassment. Now, obviously, that has undergone a huge change in recent years on the back of the Me Too movement, the Harvey Weinstein allegations, President's Club, and all that. And you'll be familiar with lots of that background, so we won't traverse that in any detail. What we're really going to look at is how that has affected how employers respond to harassment allegations in the workplace. And we're going to look at some of the complicated bits of law and how that law is going to be or is planned to be changed by the government with some new legislation coming onto the stocks probably later this year. So let's just start to explore that changed post-Me Too world in a little bit more detail. Tabitha, what are the sort of the headlines there?
Absolutely. Thanks, Matthew. So Me Too was, of course, a turning point in how employers dealt with harassment in the workplace. We saw that women around the world began speaking up about their experiences. And while previously the tendency might have been to protect the perpetrator, given they're typically senior within the business, that wasn't the case anymore. It wasn't acceptable to simply gag women through the use of confidentiality agreements and NDAs. And it was time to make a change. Now, I'm going to speak about men and women in this podcast simply because that's how the stats work in this area. Harassment can, of course, happen to either gender, but overwhelmingly, it's usually as against women. So turning to those stats a little bit, back in 2018, the Equality and Human Rights Commission called for evidence from women and men who'd experienced harassment at work. And they found that 3/4 of people who responded had experienced sexual harassment at work, and nearly all of those were women, hence why we often talk in terms of women and men when we're listening to this topic. Now, the most common perpetrator they found was a senior colleague. However, just under 1/4 of those who responded actually reported being harassed by customers, clients, or service users. And that's known as third-party harassment. And that's important as that links to the new legislation that we're going to be talking about later today, because it's a real missing piece of the puzzle in terms of the legal protection the law offers us. So there's not just been Me Too that was a turning point for us, but there's been other factors that have had a large impact in how employers treat staff. And one of those is regulators. So regulators had previously failed to take a sufficiently active role in using their various enforcement powers to sanction workplace harassment. We saw a real movement in the financial services sector, where individuals are now held to account through the senior managers and certification regime, where staff are determined to be fit and proper to perform their roles. And also our own regulator, the SRA, is taking an increasingly interventionist approach in order to determine whether a certain conduct is acceptable or not.
So in case you don't know what the SRA is, that's the Solicitors Regulation Authority. I'll just pop in and interrupt you there.
Oh, thanks, Matthew. No, that's helpful. We've actually also, in the past few months, seen more interventionist action from the Equality and Human Rights Commission itself. There have been 2 reports that have hit the headlines, and that's because they're such well-known brands. The first was McDonald's, and the second was IKEA. And in each case, we read that those organizations had entered into a legal agreement to improve policies and practices in relation to sexual harassment. So looking at that in a bit more detail, in IKEA's case, they committed to reviewing the way they deal with sexual harassment and to meet their responsibilities under the Equality Act. So they agreed to communicate a zero tolerance approach to sexual harassment to all staff, work with a specialist external law partner to support the organization in policies and procedures, and provide training. It's not very much, if you ask me, if you look at what your legal obligation is anyway. What did you think about that, Matthew?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most interesting thing about the commission's intervention in those 2 examples is that employers always assume that the real risk of poor behavior at work is claims from individuals. And that's 95% of the time warranted. If I harass Tabitha at work or she harasses me, we each have a claim against the other and vicariously against the firm that employs us. But as these 2 examples demonstrate, regulators can take action as well. And it's been very rare up to now. I think, you know, I've been in practice a long old time. And I must say, I can't remember seeing too many legal agreements under Section 23 of the Equality Act. But and now we've got 2 that have come along in quick succession, and they demonstrate the Commission's willingness to intervene. and the publicity that attaches to that intervention, but also, as Tabitha quite rightly points out, the sort of statutory regulators, the Solicitors Regulation Authority for lawyers or the Financial Conduct Authority for financial institutions, or many others, Prudential Regulation Authority, and there are others in other sectors, are all taking this a lot more seriously and seeing culture as effectively part of the necessary improvements that they expect firms under their remit to take.
Absolutely. It feels to me like the Equality and Human Rights Commission is stepping in sectors that don't have another regulator to do that role for them, hence why we're seeing it in hospitality and retail.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That feels right. I don't have any inside track on the Commission's thinking or intervention strategies, but that feels right.
Make sure that everyone's got a regulator to look after their interests.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that ties in to go into a different area of law for a moment. But, you know, we've talked in the past about whistleblowing. And again, that's normally something that's colleague to colleague problem. But in some cases, you're allowed to make disclosures to regulators to trigger protections. And that sort of is all of a piece, isn't it?
Yeah. So we thought we would start, after our overview, with a little look at the statutory definitions and the law around harassment, because it comes up in a few places. So first of all, there's the Equality Act. Now, that makes three types of harassment unlawful. These are harassment related to a relevant protected characteristic, sexual harassment, and then the third category is less favourable treatment of a worker because they submit to or reject sexual harassment or harassment related to sex or gender reassignment. So let's unpack the first one first, harassment related to a relevant protected characteristic. I'm sure you've all heard what the protected characteristics are, but just for completeness, age, disability, gender reassignment, race, religion or belief, sex and sexual orientation. The reason I'm flagging them is because with regards to the harassment legislation, pregnancy and maternity and marriage and civil partnership are not protected. However, if you do harass someone because of pregnancy or maternity, you'll find it will be, in most cases, related to sex in any event. So harassment related to a protected characteristic arises when a worker is subject to unwanted conduct that is related to a protected characteristic and has the purpose or effect of violating the worker's dignity or creating an intimidating, hostile, degrading, humiliating, or offensive environment. So what is unwanted conduct? That means unwanted by the worker. So you need to consider it from their subjective point of view. External factors may be considered in deciding whether that view is unwanted, but really you've got to make sure that you look at it in terms of how did that make the worker feel? How did the worker react to that? And it covers an awful lot of wide-ranging behavior, such as spoken or written words, obviously, the topic that all lawyers hate, banter, posts or contact on social media, facial expressions, I'm making some to Matthew now, or indeed, of course, physical behavior. So it's a really broad ranging, anything can amount to the type of behavior.
And because of that subjective element, Tabitha, would you say that that is a low threshold or a, you know, a very high bar for a potential claimant to meet or somewhere in the middle?
It should be a low bar because it should be taken in terms of how did that make that worker feel. You often find when you're looking at these cases that your thirst for is you want to kind of look at it from your own perspective. So you hear the conduct and you think, well, was it that bad? So you might find that in terms of jokes that are made. Everyone has a view on whether a joke is offensive or if it might have violated their dignity. But it's not about how you take it. It's about how that worker took it. And that's really important to remember for employers. So don't try and input your own view when considering these cases.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that the threshold is met where conduct is related to a characteristic. So that doesn't necessarily mean, does it, that you have to be the target? So if I tell a racist joke now, the fact that you're not a particular ethnicity that's being targeted by the joke doesn't stop it being offensive or doesn't stop you being offended by it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that can come in many ways. It can be coming because either you might be perceived to be of that protected characteristic, you might be offended because of it, you might be associated to someone with that protected characteristic. But as Matthew says, it's not just a direct attack at you because you hold that protected characteristic. You might find, therefore, that you're in a scenario where you have an employee who makes an offensive racist joke, and not only does the person of the protected characteristic bring a claim, but others affected by it might as well. So you might find that you have a broad group of people who are able to claim harassment following that poor behaviour.
Interesting. So should we move on to sexual harassment? Is that materially different?
So sexual harassment occurs when a worker is subjected to unwanted conduct and which is of a sexual nature. So it need not be sexually motivated, but only sexual in nature. So what does that mean in terms of normal speak? Well, it means it includes sexual jokes, displaying sexual or graphic pictures. So for example, if someone was showing on their phone an inappropriate picture, or to go a little bit old school, pulling out a page 3 of a newspaper, that could amount to it too. Leering, gestures, spreading sexual rumours. And two categories that I think are particularly interesting: unwelcome touching, well, we can all assume that, but also unwelcome hugging or massages.
I thought you might say massages in this bit.
I thought it was important.
And presumably, does that conduct, that sexual nature conduct, presumably it still has to have the intimidating, degrading purpose or effect?
It does, yes.
Got it. Okay. And as you say, there's that huge range, isn't there, from, you know, a sort of an off-colour joke at the perhaps less serious end to very serious sexual assault at the most senior serious end.
Exactly. So it's important to think about that in terms of when you have a report come to you of sexual harassment, to know that it is a wide-ranging behaviour and can capture both ends of the spectrum.
Understood.
I was just going to say that there is actually a third category, which we don't see as much in practice, but I didn't want to leave off the podcast today. And that's less favourable treatment for rejecting or submitting to unwanted conduct. I think this one's actually quite important to touch on because it puts it in practice. So I'm going to give you the example here that we see in the commission's report. And they talk about how a female worker has a brief sexual relationship with her supervisor. She tells the supervisor it was a mistake. And then the next day, the supervisor is furious about this. So he tries to come on to her and say, "You're playing hard to get." And she says, "Get off. I'm not playing hard to get." And after that, the supervisor makes things difficult for her at work. And that's where this category comes in. It's less favorable treatment because that person was rejected. So it might be the supervisor there that's in trouble, but it also might be, so taking this even further, this example, if that supervisor had then told their line manager, who's their pal at work, about this rejection, and the line manager thinks this is outrageous, she was asking for it, I'm going to now deny her a promotion. Well, that person's also implicit. So there you've got sexual harassment from two individuals within the organisation. So I just mentioned that to complete the picture of what we see under the Equality Act.
And that's presumably quite difficult in practice for employers to police because, you know, workplaces are staffed with people who are by their kind of nature of like minds. And so people will be friendly and that's to be encouraged. And they will often form relationships, which is also not a terrible thing, but it's where those relationships perhaps go wrong or that people overstep the line in the getting to the relationship stage that legal risk arises.
Yes, absolutely. So sexual relationships or just relationships generally at work can be difficult to police because, of course, people have a right to a private life. But equally, the workplace is somewhere where we see a lot of power imbalance. So workplaces must keep an eye on this. And we see it through records or consents to HR where people are in a consensual relationship. That can be a good idea of a practical measure to put in place because it is for the employer to get involved if a senior supervisor is having a relationship with a junior in order to ensure that that junior remains protected.
So we see some clients asking for relationship policies, relationship at work policies, although I think that's probably not yet absolutely the normal position for all clients.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think we see it from time to time, or just a less formal declaration or record is encouraged rather than a formal policy. It usually depends on the size of the organisation, I'd say, on that one, as to whether we see it or not.
Interesting. And so put it into sort of the blunt example. So I am horrible to you. Is your only claim just against me as an individual? When do employers become liable? Let's get back to the black letter law for a moment.
Yes, of course. So employers are liable for acts of harassment committed by one worker against another one of their workers, committed by one worker against a job applicant or former worker, committed by an agent acting on their behalf against one of their workers. So I'll pause on that one because I think one interesting area where we often see it actually is in the recruitment world. So you have to be very careful about what your recruiters are doing on your behalf.
You're absolutely right to bang on about that, because it's really important that all discrimination law applies to throughout the employment life cycle. The moment you submit an application, all the way beyond employment even, for instance, the giving of references after employment has ended, and harassment is a form of discrimination, be attached to candidates and employees alike.
Absolutely. And it's not just your staff, it's broader than that. So it's those agents acting on your behalf. So essentially, employers are liable for harassment committed by their workers in the course of their employment, unless they can rely on the reasonable steps defence. And it does not matter whether or not the employer knows about the harassment.
And so I guess there are two questions obviously there. What are reasonable steps, and when is something in the course of employment? Those sound fiendishly difficult.
Yeah, they are, of course. So I can give you a very straightforward answer. And how do you take all reasonable steps? Well, you take all reasonable steps if there are no further steps that could have reasonably expected to be taken.
What a beautifully circular lawyer's argument that is.
Yes. So there's no prescribed minimum about what an employer can do to prevent harassment and protect its workers. It's an objective test, and you look at it in terms of the size, the nature, to be honest, the funds that the employer has, the resources available to it, and the risks that need to be addressed within that sector. The Equality Commission has a lot of examples in its guidance. So that's the Sexual Harassment and Harassment at Work Technical Guidance about what employers could do. So you'd be very well placed to take on some of those examples. So let's think about those in practice. Well, the bare minimum that we expect to see is a good policy. So your friendly lawyers, McFarlane's, will have hopefully prepared one for you or can help you prepare one. Off the shelf is okay, but you really want to think about it and tailor it to your organization and make sure you've put the time in to really think about that policy. You then need to make sure that everyone's been made aware of that policy. So you might want to train your staff on the policy. You want to make sure it's very visible. A good idea actually is to post it on your external website so that it's available, for example, if a staff member's off sick and not necessarily on their work emails, it's easily accessible. Training. That's very important. You might want to run sexual harassment training both internally and using external providers. You also want to carry out risk assessments, identify, for example, particularly relationships that might be vulnerable within the workplace to harassment. And there I'm talking about identifying perhaps where there's imbalances of power that need to be kept an eye on to check. Give people the ability to speak up. We're seeing a lot of this, Matthew, aren't we, with the introduction of speak up websites, which are essentially used for whistleblowing as well as harassment.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I think they're a key part of an employer's reasonableness armory, aren't they? The routes through which people can alert management to things that are, inverted commas, not okay, the better that is. It shows both that you're taking the problem seriously, you're giving as many platforms as possible for people to make their concerns known, but you're also able then to capture more data and see where the problems lie, if they're in a particular department, a particular team, or whether your profile is improving or getting worse over time.
Yes, and I'll just throw in there that I often wear a second hat at work, which is my data protection hat, and there's a lot of nervousness about introducing this type of measure, because you're collecting obviously a lot of special category and personal data. I just want to say that it's not impossible to put these measures in place, and it's in fact encouraged to do so. But when you are putting them in place, it is worth taking legal advice to ensure that you've carried out the proper procedures expected of you by the ICO, because you've got a balancing tension there between respecting people's rights to privacy, but also protecting your workforce and taking reasonable steps when it comes to harassment.
I ought to jump in and say Tabitha's being very modest there when she says she has a second data protection hat. She has a very large second data protection hat. And if you have any data protection questions at all, then you can't do a great deal better than asking Tabitha for her views.
Oh, thanks, Matthew.
And that, I guess apart from the data protection angle, it's probably worth just flagging, just again for the sake of completeness, the Protection from Harassment Act, which was originally introduced in 97, I think, to deal with stalking. You know, it's there and available for claimants in some cases, but it's not sort of the go-to piece of legislation from an employment perspective. But it is there, and where sexual harassment or harassment generally is at the more serious end, really like the criminal sort of test for harassment, then that's a sort of secondary level of protection that's available in some cases. I won't say more about that, but because it's not purely on point, just to throw it in there.
Make sure we complete the picture. There's always more than one route in order to bring a claim, you'll find. So it's worth understanding where all your obligations lie and what you can do to help prevent claims and make a nicer place to work. We were also going to touch on the phrase of, let's finish off on our black letter lesson before we come on to the new legislation. We just wanted to finish off by talking about what in the course of employment means. It's a tricksy phrase, and you can find that acts committed in the workplace or in any other place where the worker is working can be caught. So that catches places where you might find that bad behavior occurs, such as offsites, trips away with staff, basically where people let their hair down or alcohol's involved. We see an increased uptick in poor behavior. So it will capture you even if you're not in the office.
And so presumably that's, you know, from the impromptu drink around the corner after a hard day in the office, as you say, to much more formal things. How far, I mean, this is probably one of those piece of string questions, but how far away from the office do you have to be for it to become no longer in the course of employment? Is that just impossible to be general about, and it depends on all the factors?
I actually think that is a really difficult question for me to answer off the cuff, not because I'm trying to dodge it, but because it is so fact specific. So you might find that the tribunal draws a distinction between two individuals who happen to work at the same workplace but have never come into contact with each other through work versus something that occurred on a trip that was not arranged through work but still involved a lot of colleagues. It's always going to be fact specific unless you disagree and you've got a magic answer for me.
No, not at all. I was hoping you had the magic answer, but perhaps there just isn't a magic answer, and that's why lawyers exist, to advise on case-specific examples.
Exactly.
Feel free to send your case-specific examples Tabitha's way after you've finished this podcast.
Yeah.
Presumably it's not, you know, bad behavior doesn't just give rise to discrimination, harassment risks. Presumably we've got the normal rules about unfair dismissal and so on that are there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's right not to forget those. So you've got to make sure always that you're thinking about fair process when you're handling, both from both parties' perspective, because I think sometimes there's a little bit too much emphasis on making sure that the perpetrator is also protected, but you've got to make sure both parties are. You often find you're talking in terms of allegations rather than proved matters. So confidentiality is key. Follow a fair process to avoid claims of unfair dismissal. Make sure you treat the parties equally when you're investigating to avoid any sex discrimination. So if, for example, you always believe the woman over the man, which perhaps might be less likely, but it could happen, you've just got to make sure you're not giving other people claims when you're looking at these matters.
And then you talked right at the beginning of this conversation about regulator scrutiny over confidentiality agreements. We probably should just circle back to that, because it's such a critical aspect of this conversation.
Yes, it is, and quite rightly so. You'll remember with Me Too, there was a lot of focus on the NDAs, as they were called, that were entered into, especially in relation to the Harvey Weinstein matter. That's a difficult topic for us employment lawyers, because settlement agreements are part and parcel of what they do. A settlement agreement waives statutory and contractual claims against an employer, but often that also includes within it a confidentiality clause. And that confidentiality clause might be as to the terms that are offered, because, for an example, an employer doesn't want to have stated exactly what quantum they've offered in each case. It might extend to the existence of the settlement agreement, because the employer doesn't want people to know that it enters into settlement agreements, as is its right. However, since Me Too, we've seen some very fair carve-outs being both suggested and required, and they relate to the ability to report a claim to the police where required. That should always be carved out, and to the regulator as well. But we also see now quite regularly the ability for an individual to be continue to be able to speak to their medical professional instructed in the matter. And that's very important. So some of these are drafting changes, but it's also a change in principle when you're looking at agreed exits now. Confidentiality is okay in some circumstances, but it shouldn't be complete. And all cases of harassment should really be investigated, regardless of whether you reach settlement with the victim.
That's really interesting, isn't it? This is sort of off topic a little bit, but presumably that produces a very difficult scenario for HR teams, employment lawyers alike, management alike. What do you do if somebody alerts you to the fact that they felt uncomfortable at work, but they don't want to appear to be a difficult troublemaker, in inverted commas, and they really don't want any formal action to be taken? That seems just a really hard catch-22, aren't you, as an HR person in that scenario? What do you do?
You really are in a difficult scenario. So you should still take steps to ensure that the matter is resolved as far as you're able to. But you also need to make sure that you respect the victim's point of view and listen to them. So in a scenario like that, I would typically suggest keeping a record of the complaint and that they've requested to keep that matter confidential. I would attempt to see if we could encourage the worker to address the issue, see if they want support. Continue to check in on that individual in case it's simply a matter of time and that they're ready to deal with it at a later date. Keep the situation under review, see what measures we can put in place that won't tip off the perpetrator, and then see what else the worker wants. I mean, your key responsibility is to listen to the victim and see what you can do to help them.
Understood. And that seems very sound advice to me. So should we look ahead then to the new legislation that is making its way through Parliament at the moment?
Absolutely. So that legislation is called the Worker Protection Amendment of Equality Act 2010 Bill. It was introduced to Parliament by Liberal Democrat MP and peer as a private member's bill last year. And it subsequently won the support of the government. So that makes its passage into law a little bit more likely. So there's two key components under that bill. The first is that employers in the UK would face a positive duty to take all reasonable steps to prevent their employees experiencing workplace sexual harassment. Matthew, what do you think about the positive duty as compared to what we've got at the moment?
Well, I mean, the fact that it uses the phrase all reasonable steps, your natural instinct is to say, well, that exists already. That's just the reasonable steps defence converted into a slightly different legislative form. But I think the government's aim here is to change the way that we think about an employer's obligation. So it's not just saying, you get out of jail if you can show you've taken reasonable steps. It's flipping it so that you are actually obliged to take reasonable steps off the bat. And so that from a sort of pure legal risk perspective, there's not a huge amount of change. But I think, in terms of optics and how employers are encouraged to look at their workplace and how they protect staff, then I think it does make a change.
So we might look at putting in place the measures we highlighted earlier in the podcast and ensuring that they're in place as a matter of course, rather than just as a defence. So on setup, it might be something you do immediately, policies, training, awareness, etc., and have it on a yearly roster to check in that you've done all those things.
That's exactly right, because it won't be enough to wait for the claim and then say, oh yes, but we've done all these things, so please don't fine us. That won't be good enough. You'll actually have an obligation, as you say, to put those steps in place from the outset.
I'll be interested to see how it's policed as well, that one. And then the second tenet of it is that the bill makes provision for employers to be liable for harassment of staff by third parties. So I touched on this right at the start of the podcast, because so many people have found that they've been subject to harassment by clients, suppliers, or customers. And that protection is going to extend to all protected characteristics, not just sexual harassment. Didn't this used to be in the Act, Matthew?
It did indeed. Yeah. I mean, this is one of those yo-yo topics that has bounced in and out of the legislation throughout my whole career. Those of you who are old enough to remember the inverted commas, very heavily inverted commas, comic Bernard Manning will remember he started this line of case law a long time ago when he was engaged to perform at a work event and picked on two black waitresses, did his usual appalling routine and made them the target of his jokes, inverted commas jokes, because they're not, it's never funny to ridicule people. And And so the question for the got all the way to the House of Lords then was whether or not the employer of those waitresses was responsible for this person's failed attempt at comedy. And then, you know, it's, as Tabitha says, it was then crystallized in law for a while. Then the government repealed those provisions, saying that other pieces of legislation, like the Protection from Harassment Act that I spoke about, or the health and safety legislation, or the law of constructive dismissal, provided adequate remedies. Lots of commentators felt that that was probably a little bit over generous to the power of those other pieces of legislation, and that third party harassment ought to have been maintained as a specific wrong under the Equality Act. And in fact, that looks as though it's now exactly going to be reintroduced.
Yes, although I noticed an interesting quote, because it used to be the case, did it not, that you had to be harassed by a third party on at least two previous occasions.
That's right. It was the three strikes and you're out rule. Yeah. It was called three strikes and you're out. That was poor drafting. And let's think of it. There's no way of disguising that. That weakened its protective power very markedly.
Well, of course, because you might have some appalling treatment from a customer on one occasion where you deserve to be protected.
Absolutely. And so that doesn't look as though that's going to make its way into this new protection. But it's right, isn't it, that it's still a sort of a reasonable steps threshold.
Yep. So there'll still be ways out of it, etc. But I think it's a step in the right direction that this is being brought back in again. And of course, at the moment, there are other ways around it. There are other claims that can be brought by individuals, especially in relation to the various discriminations. And here I'm talking about direct discrimination, indirect discrimination, etc. But I'm glad to see that it's coming back. And I imagine that's as a result of the President's Club, etc., when we realised there was a big gap in the law.
And so presumably that one of the reasonable steps that people will want to start thinking about introducing into their services agreements with third-party suppliers, customers, etc., is exactly that, you know, a sort of a contractual undertaking by that third party not to engage in harassment.
Absolutely. You might already have those in place for your various recruitment contracts where people are acting as your agent in any event, but I expect we'll see a lot more drafting coming our way as a result of this.
How interesting.
Well, I also saw recently that it's not been smooth sailing. You'd think a topic such as this would just coast through Parliament, but there's been a tension, hasn't there, Matthew, with this legislation and the impact it might have on workplace discussions.
Yeah, I mean, so the context for this is the government's commitment to free speech. I would hope that all of us have a commitment to free speech, but free speech obviously carries within it an inherent tension. Is my right to free speech to be controlled by Tabitha's right not to be offended by my speech? Yes, of course it is. It's not a universal right that has no qualification, and all of the human rights instruments across the world really have limitations on free speech. So for instance, in the UK, you have a general right to free speech, but if you incite racial hatred in doing so, then your right to free speech is curtailed. And that's right and proper, I think, and it'd be hard to find any disagreement with that. This government, as I'm sure you know, is looking at repealing the Human Rights Act and replacing it with what it calls a new Bill of Rights. And in the draft of that new Bill of Rights, the government has suggested that courts and tribunals should give great weight to freedom of speech, as opposed to any other of the protected rights that you'll all be familiar with: right to private life, right to freedom of assembly, and so on, right to a fair trial even. So they seem to be committed to free speech as a sort of a super right. I'll leave aside for a moment whether that applies to people who criticise their own policies, and whether they're quite as happy to listen or to accord those people the same freedoms. But yeah, so I think that's sort of the context for this drafting about workplace discussions. And so in short, the idea is that one of the reasonable steps that you won't be required to take is sort of policing normal workplace discussion, unless those conversations are, I think the phrase is grossly offensive, isn't it?
Yeah, indecent or grossly offensive. So what they're trying to do is make sure that it doesn't capture conversations where the opinion isn't directed at the employee. We'll see how this works in practice, because if Matthew and I were having an indecent conversation and the person sat next to us overheard, it's a difficult tension, isn't it, to try and protect the feelings of that person versus crushing all workplace conversation and having very harsh policies preventing any types of conversations that might happen in the workplace. It's a tough balancing act. I understand that. But
it would be hard on the law as it stands. You know, we talked earlier on about, you know, if I tell a racist joke that isn't directed at you, you're quite properly going to feel offended by it. I mean, that's straightforward. And that will be true under this new provision as well, because that racist joke, I think everyone would say, would be grossly offensive. By the same token, if you and I are just having a normal chat that isn't grossly offensive, it's very hard to see on the current law and or in this new provision how that could give rise to liability anywhere.
True, but I do worry about the inclusion of grossly offensive, that we are raising the bar somewhat in terms of that subjective view that we came back to right at the start of the podcast. But we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. And also the amendment isn't set to apply to cases of sexual harassment. So if two employees were, for example, showing each other highly offensive sexual pictures and a third employee were to walk by, they would still be caught within the scope of the legislation, even if they didn't hit that grossly offensive test.
And I think hopefully most of you will agree that that is right and proper.
I'd hope so.
That's probably an early advert for the part two of this podcast, which we'll probably try to get out, well, at some point once this drafting becomes in final form, and then we'll hopefully come back and bother your ears with this same topic again. To sum up then, so we're saying reasonable steps is really the key to all of this, and that encompasses policies, training, and taking action where concerns are found to have been validly raised. Is that a fair summary?
That is a fair summary. But all I would add to that is don't wait for the event to happen to put in place your measures. So especially now with this new duty, take the proactive steps, check everything's up to speed, organize your training, sort your policies. It's a good time to review everything that you might have put in place a number of years ago. Perhaps you reviewed in light of Me Too, but it's time to review again.
And as with all things cultural, if you have a bad tone from the top, then cultural change is very hard to embed. And so to all you senior managers listening, not senior managers in a financial services context, but senior staff generally, it's really up to you to set the tone and create an inclusive, harmonious culture for us all to work in.
Yep. And I would add to that, I've read a few articles that Gen Z, who are entering the workforce now, simply won't stand for it like previous generations have. They're the first generation to enter the workforce in the post-Me Too era, and they have very different views on the matter, quite rightly so. So listen to your staff in every generation to make sure that you're up to speed on what you need to do nowadays.
Sage advice. And with that, we will bring this conversation to a close. So it only remains for me to thank Tabitha very much for her time and her wise thoughts. And we will be back hopefully again with you next month.
Thank you, Matthew.
Many thanks for listening.